This is Owen Thompson with the Local Journalism Initiative. This interview is with a young Toronto composer about his debut production, Tango for Two, which is set to premiere on October 21st. So yeah, would you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, my name is Jonathan Kravchenko. I'm the composer for Tango for Two, and that's what we're going to be discussing today, the new opera that we're going to be premiering on October 21st at Trinity St. Paul's in downtown Toronto. And I've been composing for a long time.
So you said that you're a composer, and you've been, how long have you been working in this industry for?
In the industry?
Yeah, the opera industry.
Oh, the opera industry. I wouldn't really call it an opera industry because it's not like a heavy machinery style thing. I guess it's better to call it the musical sphere. And I guess if we're going to go then that route, then I've been in the musical sphere my whole life. Music has always been like a big part of my life for me, starting from a young age, going from, you know, concerts at the U of T or concerts at different concert halls that we have here in Toronto, Kerner Hall, Roy Thompson, and kind of immersing yourself in that world. So it's hard to say how long. I mean, 10 years plus, at least. I mean, to say how long have we been doing it professionally is a different question. And I would say it's been about a year, coming up to a year now, that this has been like the full-time thing that I'm doing. So that's kind of that perspective, if we're going to go on a full-time if we're going to look at it as a full-time basis.
On that full-time basis, how exactly did you get your start?
How did I get my start? I don't believe that there's such a thing as you get your start. Like, there's not one event that you could just say, that's the moment, that's the key where, oh, okay, after that moment, everything changed. It's more of just a consistent and slow buildup of, you slowly grow with connections, you play more concerts, you write more, you get to know more people, you start to find little niches, little groups of people that, oh wow, they're like-minded people like me. It's impossible to say that there's just one moment that, oh, here's where it happened, and that was it. I wish it was that easy. And I would still say that it's still something that I'm working on. I still have, or at least I do my best to have that approach of, I haven't yet fully made it, in quote unquote, if that makes any sense. Because I feel like if you give someone the attitude of, oh, you made it, then that's okay. What's the motivation to do anything then? Just relax and do what you like. I don't know, get a farm or something. But I think it's really important, especially in music, to always have that, okay, like, we did this, great, let's make it better, let's make the next show better. How are we going to change the script for next time? Okay, you talk with, you know, artists and actors and everyone else, and you're figuring, okay, how can we make it better? We still haven't yet made it, is at least the attitude, regardless of what other people think.
And how is that attitude of always striving, always looking to improve, and never really, I guess, saying that you've made it, how does that affect your work?
Well, it makes it tricky in some degrees, because we'll have scripts that are changing by the week, because everyone's like, well, why don't we just improve this? Okay, let's improve this, and then let's improve this. I personally don't really... I mean, it makes some things a little bit more difficult. It makes other things a little bit easier. It definitely makes you a lot calmer on the day of the concert, because you know that you've made every edit that you possibly could make, and that you're completely happy with the product. But that doesn't mean that after the concert you think, oh, well, they kind of really like this. I was expecting that they were going to like this. Okay, well, let's go change it and let's add more of that. So it makes it a little bit difficult in a sense, because there's nothing constant. You're always working on something. There's always something kind of in that field of what you're focusing on. But in my opinion, I think it's the right approach, because I think if we just wrote, you know, a first draft and said, okay, this is perfect, or even if you boil it down to like a final copy, you say, okay, this is perfect, we're just going to put it on a shelf and that's it. And it's like the, you know, the holy script that we're never going to touch. I think that's just not really the right approach. It should always be something that if someone has, like, even in our creative meetings, it's a completely open table. And if someone has an idea, we're like, okay, you know what, let's just try. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. But let's, if they're like, okay, let's change this scene. Sure. Let's see what happens. And even having this openness, it creates a very different atmosphere, even in the work environment, because a lot of other, if you look at like other opera companies or other productions, the attitude is very much top down from my experience. I don't know, maybe there are other organizations that are different, but it's very top down. It's very much like, here is your script, here are your notes. If you make a mistake, we have an issue, because either someone didn't learn their part or someone didn't do this. And it's very much like you are following instructions. That's the end of the story here. And what we want to do, and what we're doing with our group, is we're just, everyone comes to the table with an open mind, and we're open to any new ideas. So there's not an idea of, we can't change this script, it's absolutely sacred. It's, oh, I think I have an improvement, why don't we try? And sometimes we come up with, you know, we come up with ideas, and you put the script away and you sleep on it, and then you come back and you're like, that was a horrible idea, but at least we tried and now we know. Other times you'll have an idea and it's like, okay, that's actually a good idea, let's implement it. So that's the approach in terms of how it changed the work environment for us, and the workflow especially.
So it definitely sounds like there is a constantly evolving story. It's never completely done. It's never, well, I guess it's done, but there's always room for some level of improvement.
We're not giving the image that our script on October 21st has been written the night before. That's not at all the idea. I mean, this has been going on, and it's just a matter of polishing it and getting it right and getting it to the level that we want it to be. It's the same with any live band. If they're going to go play, they're going to say, okay, we played last night, how did we do? Okay, this was better, this was great, people loved this, let's add more. The entire basis of Tango as an opera started because I had two compositions that did really well. Audiences really liked them. One of them was called Tango. And so we decided, well, listen, what if people really like Tango, why don't we just give them more of Tango? And so we did Tango for Two. We pitched it to a few like audience members as just a test. What do you guys think if we do something like this? And the reactions were super enthusiastic. And that's how we got here. It's not necessary. That's kind of what I mean by having that workflow. Instead of just saying, great, they enjoyed Tango, we shall never play this piece again. You know what I mean? Like it's the attitude is a little different in terms of the way we approach this versus the way you might approach like a Beethoven sonata or even any opera, like, you know, the Italian operas or a Mozart opera. It's different.
So speaking on that difference, it was when I first found out about your show Tango for Two, it was pitched to me as a opera nova. When I went to go Google what exactly an opera nova was, the first few results were, or actually all of the results were of a Italian fencing manual from the 16th century. And I don't imagine that your description of opera nova, it involves sword play and learning how to fence. So in your own words, what is opera nova?
So yeah, it has nothing to do with 16th century fencing in Italy, that's for sure. The idea that we came up with and why we actually wanted to give it this new name is purely simple. Opera as itself has a very, I would call it, dusty reputation, in the sense that if you go to anyone on say, for example, with Dundas Square, and ask them, what do you think of opera? They're probably going to be like, ah, well, 17th century powdered wigs, you know, Mozart, like all this I wouldn't call it outdated, but very kind of ancient stuff in a sense. You know what I mean? Like 1800s was 200 years ago. We're looking at 200-year-old operas here. And so the idea was, how can we make this current? How can we make this something that is new? It's not your regular, you know, there's no powdered wigs on stage at all. It's not a live, it's not a musical. So what are we going to name it? So we said, okay, well, it is featuring opera singing. Okay, great. Let's just call it Opera Nova. It works. And it sounds, you know, in my opinion, it sounds not bad. It sounds pretty good. But it gives you that, it gives the name a certain feel that it's new. It's not something, you know, this isn't just any opera that you can just go and see. Or, you know, there's people that have seen like 25 productions of the same opera and they're like comparing productions. That's not the direction we want to go. In the same way that I would say, take the word, for example, circus, right? And you think of clown, you know, red nose, makeup, I don't know, like bear on a bicycle. And then you look at some, like a group like Cirque du Soleil and what they did with circus. where it's circus, but they completely reinvented it. And, you know, they gave it their own name, they gave it their own stamp. So I guess we're kind of taking inspiration from that and doing the same with opera, in the sense that we don't want it to be the powdered wigs and the big dresses and all of that. Sure, there's an audience for that and there's a market for that. Great. But that's just not the way that I believe things have to go, because things have to change. Things have to move forward with how times are changing, right? I mean, there's ideas now that could not have possibly existed 200 years ago. You could have opera concerts that happen over Zoom. I mean, who could have even thought that that was a possibility back then? So I think it has to be evolving with the times. And that's why we wanted to rename it, so that we don't have to battle with that old kind of impression. It's like, yes, we're inspired by that. Great. That collection of work that existed 100 years ago, 200 years ago plus, is a great collection. It's some of the most beautiful music ever written. But what about the 21st century? We need to start our own bookshelf, I guess you could say. And so that's what we're doing.
Sonically speaking, what is different from classical opera to opera nova?
Sonically speaking, I mean, you mean by like how the music is going to sound?
Yes.
So generally, I mean, opera singing as a form in terms of how they actually sound like is going to be the same. This is not like a Mirvish musical production where we're doing, you know, rock numbers and everyone doing that. No, that's not what we're doing. That's the largest element of opera that we're keeping, which is that the kind of classical style of singing. And although the music is modern, and if we're going to go into music terms, then there is, you know, a slight neoclassicism and almost like post-romanticism in as like an inspiration, as a base for the music. But it's by no means, you know, 21st century experimental. It's still very melodic and almost romantic, you could say, in terms of how it sounds. So that's what we're really keeping. We're keeping that sound, because I think that's what's really what keeps the genre. Because if we take away that, then, I mean, we're just doing, I don't even know what we're doing at that point. So we're keeping that, and we're incorporating dance, which is the largest element as the storytelling medium. So it's a lot more of it's a visual story, which I think, in my opinion, especially now with screens and phones, is much more powerful to tell a story to anybody. You know, you have ads, they're not just words on pieces of paper, they're pictures, people are visual. And so adding more visual elements and having the story told in a visual way is really important. That's something that we're incorporating into it.
Let's just quickly move on to the next topic here, which is the opera itself, Tango for Two. What is Tango for Two about?
So Tango as a story follows the story of a young sailor it happens on the Atlantic coast of Canada, and it follows the adventures of a young sailor who happens to meet a beautiful girl. There's a romance story that happens, and you know, obviously there's a fair bit of tragedy, a fair bit of, you know, there's the lighthearted moments, there's the dark moments, and but all ends happily. I don't want to spoil away too much about the story, but it follows that kind of nautical theme. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. And it kind of follows that, so it's a theme that is played in throughout the story. Obviously, there's tango involved, and they do dance tango. So it's a lighthearted romantic story is the best way I would describe it.
And that way of telling the story specifically, the nautical themes with the, I guess, the Spanish influence of tango. How did you end up deciding on having that mix?
On that specific mix of tango and like, why not any other dance in a sense?
Because typically when you think of nautical themed or nautical based adventures, you would typically think of, you know, it's like sea shanties and whatnot as, I guess, beautiful and as like tango. It seems like a good, it's like a juxtaposition. So how did you come up with that juxtaposition?
Well, it's not a matter of juxtaposition. I mean, it's a matter of having diversity in the plot and having something that's interesting to look at visually for the audience. That's the most important. At the end of the day, our goal is to give people the best possible experience at our show that we can give. That's our goal. And how we do that, that's already another story. The other, we looked at many different plot options and then plot lines that we could run with. And the end of the line is this, that if you have everything happen in one setting with one element, I would be hard pressed to find someone who would be interested in an opera that consists of only sea shanties. That would be pretty tough to listen to. You'd have to be a pretty big fan to enjoy that. And so it's a matter of having diversity in the plot, having diversity in the script, and having something new. I mean, the fact that we're even discussing is like, well, that's a bit strange. That's okay, that's interesting, but why? And that's exactly what we wanted to accomplish. That question of, okay, tango, where's tango? So now you have a question. And so now you have an interest. And now that makes the concert interesting. That makes the show interesting. There was many, many other reasons that we looked at it. There was another composition. When we originally, if we go back to how tango was written from a basis point, like from very ground up, the original idea was that I was performing at a few different concerts and I had some solo pieces. One of them was called Tango for Two. And there was another composition which then got rewritten for cello and piano, which was called Blue Whale. Two relatively unrelated compositions, except for the fact that I both wrote them. But other than that, they're not necessarily linked in any way. And Blue Whale was an interesting one for me because the idea came from how could you musically depict like a blue whale? Because they're an interesting animal if you look at it, like they're huge. And so we had this really beautiful flowing melody and the cello was playing pretty low and it turned out really nice. And actually, we're planning on making a recording of it, like a higher, you know, quality CD recording of it later. And so when we started writing Tango, the idea became, okay, well, since we're incorporating Tango, what other hits could we include that would go over well, and pieces that the audience already knew, pieces that we could tell the audience, oh, that's going to be in the opera, and they're, oh yeah, this is going to be great. And Blue Whale was one of them. And so people really liked it. And so we were like, well, listen, let's add it in. And we already had that nautical theme of having the sailor in there. The question, we were just drafting out different ideas. And then when we had Tango and Blue Whale to work with, I mean, it just fit together very nicely in the end. In terms of costumes, I think they did a fantastic job. They got perfect red, this beautiful red flowing dress. I don't know if I showed you some of the photographs, or maybe you have the photographs that are in the media kit. I think it creates a stunning visual impact as well, because you get two colors that are very contrasting. You get red for Tango and blue for your water element and that nautical theme. And you don't have a bland set. You don't have a bland story.
You've been talking a lot about these visuals, and I think you've explained it quite well about how important these visuals are in terms of storytelling and captivating the audience. When it comes to costume design, which is what I think when people look on stage and they see people, it's what they're wearing. So you brought up that the costume design has been incredible, and I can see the photos here of the media kit. It looks very visually stunning. Or how did everybody come to the conclusion of the colors used in some of these costumes, like this bright, vibrantly bright red dress?
Well, when you think of Tango, I mean, one of the first things you immediately think of is just red. It's not a matter of a creative decision. It's just, if you look historically at any tango dancer, if you're taking Latin themes, red is also a color that comes out a lot. Just type into Google tango dancer and chances are you're going to see red. That was obviously kind of one, I suppose you could say it's a prejudice when you go into this design sessions and you start looking at, okay, how are we going to do this? It's a prejudice that you come into it. But it's the same with anything. If you say someone, if you tell someone in costumes, okay, we want to do something like a dinner party, then everyone's prejudice is immediately going to go to probably like tuxedo or something like that. So that obviously is a factor. But when we were looking at the nautical theme, I mean, in terms of overall color design, you want contrasting colors because that's what makes it vivid and that's what makes it interesting. So if you have a scene that's all blue, it's like, okay, that works for maybe 5-10 minutes. But after that, is it just blue for forever and that's it? So having the red and the blue, you get two really, really contrasting elements, two contrasting colors. And when you have two different characters that are also very kind of very opposite characters in that sense, then you get that kind of amazing symbiosis where the costumes elevate the performers. The costumes and the contrast of the colors gives them more opportunity to express the emotions of the story, especially via dance. Because the way the story is built is that you have two opera singers that are kind of narrating and guiding the story as two dancers, like fantastic professional dancers that we're working with, they kind of create that visual effect of that story. So you're almost getting the story twice in a sense. You're hearing the story, but you're also seeing it happen in front of you via dance. And when you combine that with a striking visual element, something like a bright red and dark blue, and we still haven't had the photos come out yet for the official costumes, like besides the media kit photos, it just amplifies the story to another degree. We don't want the costumes to be something like, oh, this is the focus of the show. Everyone's here to see the costumes. It's not a fashion show. But at the same time, it gives the dancers especially a platform, and a much larger platform, or a blank canvas, if you will, to express the emotions and to express their story. It just gives it a deeper element than just doing it all monotone.
So I want to rewind just a little bit closer to the start of the interview. You brought up a couple of times now regarding your compositions that you've written for school. So where did you go to school?
So I'm finishing up my studies with Royal Conservatory at the moment. So I still have about a year to go with that. And other than that, it's been a lot of through mentorships mainly. I mean, I'll send you a list later of some people that I've worked with. I've worked with, like, Jerry Shadford was a huge inspiration to me, because that was one of my first teachers that said, doing something creative is not bad in the sense that, you know, when you're playing your Bach etudes and you're doing all that, there's an attitude of perfectionism. There's an attitude of, you play the wrong note, that's it, there's a punishment. He was one of the first to say, well, why don't you expand on that? Why don't you add your own creative ideas? He was a huge element in just giving that creative boost. And then after that, working with other composers, and right now with my mentorship under John Gray, he's worked with John Beckwith, and how you couldn't really ask for a better mentor in terms of compositions. So it's working with that, and it's a lot more effective, I find, than even just going to a lecture or anything like that. I mean, you're one-on-one with someone who is actually in that field and who has been in that field for ages. And so you come and you're like, okay, well, listen, I have this script, I have this score, can we take a look? What do you think? And then all of a sudden he's finding insights that I never even thought of. And so every session that we have together, especially with John, is just such a mind opener for me. And it has a huge influence on my creative style as well, because it opens ideas that I didn't even think were possible. So in terms of study, I kind of went a little bit sideways with that, but in terms of study, yeah, it's with the conservatory is obviously great. I mean, their program is just fantastic, and it gives you that foundation that you need in terms of, like, theory, in terms of just, okay, here's what we need to know. Where it's lacking I would say what elevates it to another level is when you have that real world experience where you're just being able to be at a table with other composers who are sitting, okay, and discussing a score. Even if you're just a fly on the wall in that kind of situation, you're already learning so much.
Is Tango for Two your first major production?
Yeah, this is going to be the first production that we're doing. Other than that, I mean, I've performed as a soloist and with other concerts that I've organized and other concerts that we've put on and things like that. But this is going to be the first real production, quote unquote, that we're doing. Because it's an opera. It's not like just any other concert. It's just, you know, it's not a recital. Recital is relatively simple. You roll out a piano, you do your thing, and then you're out. But here, there's a whole host of other elements that we have to work with.